you're listening to this podcast and you think, that is me, I look at a job description or a job advert and I think, I'm just not up to the grade, what's the harm in applying? They can only say no.
From Marine Society, Britain's oldest maritime charity, this is the Coming Ashore podcast, bringing you insights and anecdotes from maritime professionals into the world of shipping, aimed at helping seafarers to come ashore or those looking for guidance after already making the transition shoreside. Coming Ashore is a mentor programme delivered in association with Maritime London, the ITF Seafarers Trust and Nautilus International. It looks to help seafarers secure employment in shoreside roles across the maritime industry. And now, let's get straight into today's podcast. Hello and welcome to the Coming Ashore podcast. Each episode we look to learn a little bit more about the maritime industry and the people who keep it running. My name is Will Fuller and sat opposite me is one of my co-hosts, Nathaniel Phelps.
Hi, Will.
Morning. Unfortunately, our third host, James, can't be with us today. He is a massive fan of old cars and while all his cars are old, today they are also all broken. Today we are, though, joined by a special guest who's going to help us understand the life and work of a seafarer by talking to Anne Pletschke. She is a fifth-generation seafarer, a business owner, surveyor, DPA, and has over 20 years of experience in the industry. Anne, welcome.
Thank you very much. Pleased to be here.
It's great to have you. So, let's get started. If you could visit any lighthouse in the world, which one would it be and why?
Now, there is a question, which will probably also challenge my knowledge of lighthouses. It's quite a toss-up, this one, because part of me is thinking that there are some amazing lighthouses around the coast of Ireland, and I know there was a series about them which I've still not watched and I want to, so part of me is saying one of those, but I can't actually get away from the fact that I got married in Cape Town in South Africa and my wedding photos were done in the shadow of a lighthouse down on the coast, one of the bays outside Cape Town called Komaki. So seeing as I have a picture of this lighthouse in my living room, I've never been up that lighthouse. All I did was flaunt around a wedding dress underneath it for a time. I would quite like to actually visit that lighthouse one day.
That'd be awesome. I'll be honest, I was slightly worried about that question when we said about it because I was thinking, how much do people know about lighthouses? But that was probably a better answer than I ever could have expected.
I have to admit, I did have a bit of a panic moment when you said lighthouses and I was thinking, I'm a mariner, I should know the name of lighthouses and maybe I don't. And
I would not have. So,
well, I think Malin Head for some reason. Then I was thinking, I'm sure they've got a lighthouse, but if they haven't, then it's just embarrassing. And I can't really say the Needles because that's just... So yeah, that was a good icebreaker. You got me panicking early. Well done. Yeah,
thank you. I hope you're a little bit more settled now. Right, okay. So we'll go into the actual questions now. How did you get into the maritime industry?
Well, I'll admit it was actually something I always wanted to do. My father had been a seafarer. He'd come ashore not long before I was born, so he was never an active seafarer during my lifetime, but it was very present in the house, the pictures of his ships up. His father had been both in the Merchant Navy and Royal Navy. In both services, he started in the Merchant Navy and then very quickly switched over to the Royal Navy at the outbreak of World War II. And got an OBE, actually, for his services to the Royal Navy. So seafaring was just ever present. And I don't remember a time where I wanted to do anything else. We used to travel across to France a lot on the cross-channel ferries. And that obviously shaped me as well. And I remember being about 3 or 4 and saying, I want to be the captain of a ferry when I grow up.
So it was always the deck route as well.
It was always the deck route. Oh, heaven forbid I probably did anything else. Funnily enough, I've always been interested in engineering, and when there used to be dual cadetships, I wanted to be a dual cadet, and it finished just before I became a cadet, and I think it was an A-level route, and I came in at GCSEs, but I did initially want to be an engineer cadet, a dual cadet. I did do a AEC engineering certificate a few years ago to try and satiate some of that need. I want to do the AEC 2 top-up actually this year. So there's a little bit of engineering in me, and I'm doing a Master of Engineering at the moment. So I guess I'm deck, but a little bit polluted.
Yeah. Not sure how I feel about it. No.
I'm not sure how I feel about it, to be honest.
So the question then, did you ever manage to become a captain on a ferry?
I never became a captain of a ferry. I was night chief officer on Dover ferries at the age of 19, actually. I wasn't even 20 when I started being night mate. So that's the closest I got on ferries. I've been captain of other vessels, but never made ferry yet. But one of my guiding principles is never say never, so who knows?
Yet being the most operative word in that sentence.
Hopefully.
So you came in straight after GCSEs. How did you find that?
I came in. I applied for cadetships just before my GCSE mocks, and I think even then it was a more unusual route. There were quite a few of us that started at 16 after GCSEs, but there were more and more people starting after A-levels. But I knew I didn't want to wait and do my A-levels because I knew the career I wanted. The training program was going to be the same. And I knew that I was going to get qualified at the age of 19 with, back then it was an NVQ and an HND. And a professional ticket, so I didn't see the value of waiting two more years to do A-levels, even though I could have done, and I got good GCSE results. My heart was set on going to sea. So now I look back at it and I think, oh, 16 was quite young. I look at 16-year-olds now and I think they're children. Did I go to sea as a kid? And I guess I did, but at the time it didn't seem like that. It was me following the career path I'd always wanted to do. And enrolling in tertiary study at 16, instead of doing A-levels, I was doing an NVQ. It seemed perfectly normal, and partly still does, if I'm honest.
Yeah, well, I think if you've been thinking about it since you're about 3 or 4 years old, it doesn't feel, it's natural for it not to feel different, I suppose.
And I'm actually a big supporter in us trying to have pathways still for people like me, I was going to say kids like me, people like me who know what they want to do. And it may be now with the advent of MLC, it's quite difficult to have cadets doing their sea time before they're 18. And I do appreciate the world's changed a little bit with that. However, we've seen pre-cadetship start up, but also I can see merit in 17-year-olds starting, and that we're not needing A-levels exactly as a minimum requirement and having some non-degree routes. Because there are some very keen people out there that, for various reasons, aren't going to do post 16 education in the conventional sense, that can make excellent seafarers. And ultimately, we want to attract a diverse talent pool of good seafarers. So I'm still quite a big proponent. Even though I think, wow, I was young at 16, I still want to try and attract people like I was.
Absolutely, and I think that the HNC HND route is fantastic, because as well as attracting people like yourself who know that they want to do it straight from GCSEs, it gives people an opportunity who maybe they go off and try something else first and they're not sure about it, but they don't have they haven't gone on through higher education to then join on to a degree route or a foundation degree route. It still gives them that option to make the change later in life. I think we get some really fantastic officers through that.
I think we do. I think if you look at just some of the broad scope of some of the really good cadets we've seen in the last decade or so, even if you look at who's won Officer Trainee of the Year award, it's not monopolised by just a degree route or people that have had seafaring in their backgrounds. there's such a diverse range of cadets that have won that award. And there's a little plug here because one of my mentees, who's now a third officer, has just won Cadet of the Year.
Congratulations.
And she was an HNC route. And then she topped up, after completing her oral, she topped up to HND. But she was an HNC route, and she was the best officer trainee in the UK last year. So it just proves to me that we have a diverse talent pool, and we need diverse ways for seafarers. And that's through from ratings, apprenticeships, through to officer training and other routes. There's all sorts of unconventional routes that can produce excellent seafarers.
So with your background and your very obvious passion for seafaring, in fact, just in general, and you know, knowing what you wanted to do, would you say that's one of the biggest challenges facing the industry at the moment in terms of getting that diverse talent pool? Is that entry route is moving a little bit more to the right in people's age, and we're looking, you know, more and more people are keen to get a degree out of whatever element of higher education they go. That's clearly a challenge. What other challenges do you see to broadening that diversity?
I think I agree that we do have this challenge where we've seen this creep over the years. I mean, you know, my father's day, I think he started at 14. So we have seen it drastically change over the years, pretty much during my lifetime. That said, there are some excellent cadets that have started in their 30s and 40s, and indeed experience ratings that in their 40s and 50s have decided to go get their officer certificates. So I think that we need to honour that diversity with having as many routes as possible. I also, a little bit biased here because I am doing my master's thesis on it, but I am a really strong proponent of evolving technology and new technologies in the industry right now in creating opportunities for seafarer groups and potential seafarer groups that we've never had in the industry before. So by that, I mean, certainly in the advent of autonomous shipping, we are going to have situations where a seafarer who has potentially had a limiting accident, lost their legs, for example, could still continue seafaring but ashore in a remote control centre, or a seafarer that has diabetes who's limited severely in what ships they can be on, either with a doctor on board or very, very coastal, can now be a seafarer for a worldwide trading vessel, but from a control centre. So I'm really keen on exploring how new technologies can open up that talent pool, not just for new entrants coming in, but also the seafarers we already have. For example, women that want to start a family, they can go through the various trimesters of pregnancy and breastfeeding and still be a seafarer by being in a shore control centre. So I think we have a real opportunity the way the industry is going at the moment with evolving technology, if we harness diversity and put that central to that.
Absolutely. So interesting to look at the future of where it's going. Can we take it back to your past a bit? And so you joined it after GCSEs. Where did you go from there? Talk to us about your journey from where you joined to now.
So I started off, and I knew I wanted to be the traditional deep sea route, or that's what I thought I wanted. So I started off on very traditional deep sea refrigerated cargo vessels going across the Atlantic, carrying bananas back and general cargo out. It was quite salty sea dog stuff at the time. I knew, and I'm glad that I did that, because I did see a part of the industry that, yeah, many people don't see anymore. So it was good, but it did have its challenges. Through various reasons, I ended up finishing my cadetship on offshore supply vessels, which is ironic because before I applied for cadetships, I thought I don't want to be in the North Sea on supply vessels. And I ended up in the North Sea on supply vessels and absolutely loved it. After I got my officer of the watch, I ended up on ferries for a few years and then ended up back offshore on supply vessels for a good 6 or 7 years, doing anchor handling, platform supply. Loved it. Loved the hands-on manoeuvring. Loved the small team and everybody mucking in. It's very me. So that, in a nutshell, was my seafaring career. And I was happy doing that. There were some challenges along the way, but I was I was happy in my little niche of offshore. And then I saw a job for a marine inspector in Qatar and thought, I've been chief officer a little while, it would be good to get some transfer skills. I'll randomly apply on a whim, I'm not going to get it. They're going to have a lot more experienced master mariner candidates than me. And I ended up getting the job. So I ended up saying, right, I'll leave the sea for 1 year. I will go get some transversal experience. And then I'll come back to sea. And ended up staying ashore for 10 years in all sorts of various jobs. And I can't complain because I've had some fabulous jobs and I've lived in some great countries around the world. And I've certainly got some transversal skills and experience. I ticked that box. So I can't really complain too much. But it wasn't necessarily the career path that I was thinking of at the time.
No, I can imagine. So once you moved ashore, what can you talk us through some of the roles you've done shoreside?
So, yes, I started off as this marine inspector, which essentially was doing inspections for the oil company that I worked for. Much the same as tankers get inspected once a year. Offshore vessels also have more and more been getting inspections, so we would do our own internal vetting inspections. So I was a vetting inspector for offshore vessels, essentially. They then decided that they wouldn't do it in-house anymore, they'd do it third-party. So I quite cheekily, still in my late 20s, said, well, if I set up my own business in the United Arab Emirates, where the spot market is, will you use me as an inspector? And they said yes. So at 29, I found myself in the Middle East setting up my own business as a woman in the Middle East, not even in her 30s at the time, while studying for a master's degree at that time, just after getting married, and setting up a marine inspections and surveys business. So that was quite ballsy on my part, but it worked. Enjoyed doing that. In the process of that, other companies obviously had me on their radar, and I was approached by a large multinational offshore firm to say, can you please do things for us and not against us. You do very good inspections. We'd like you to do it. Help us improve our safety management. And at the time, I was client representative on a dive support vessel, offshore Qatar, in the middle of summer, and we'd run out of fresh water and the air conditioning wasn't working. So at a moment of weakness, I said, oh, let me just see what this job would be about. And that started a 7-year career with that company, where I started off with operational safety management for 2 years. Then I ended up as offshore safety superintendent in Angola, which was a fabulous shore job because it was a shore job, but I was offshore most of the time. Mm. It was rotational, 8 weeks on, 8 weeks off, visiting different ships, doing safety coaching, safety training, doing audits, but not as a policeman, more as a coach. It was fabulous. Mm. Then I said, I think I might take a bit of a break. And they said, no, we'd like you to move to Mauritius. And I initially turned it down. And I got a phone call again saying, no, they're going to phone you again tomorrow. And your answer is yes. So I moved to Mauritius as DPA and HSE manager for quite a large fleet. So I did that for 2 years. Then became head of safety standards and operational excellence at corporate level again. So I'd basically gone full circle back to corporate. Then COVID happened, which we know threw a lot of things up, changed quite a bit of perspective. And I thought, been in this company a while. It wasn't that I was stale, but I was just after a new challenge.
Yeah.
And I saw a job advert for chief vessel operator for an autonomous shipping company in the UK and thought, let's move back to the UK for a while and do that. Yeah. So I did chief vessel operator for an autonomous shipping company for 2 years. And now here I am, back at sea and running a business ashore and following my heart a bit. I don't want a shore career. I don't want a seagoing career. I want both now, and I'm being a little bit greedy and trying to do both.
It sounds like your career has been, whether you intended it to be this way or not, has been a lot about challenging the status quo. I can imagine going to sea as a young woman was probably quite challenging for a number of reasons. Setting up a business in the Middle East as a woman, I can imagine, was particularly challenging. And then again, working in Angola. So I Originally, I was thinking, well, what's the biggest challenge you've faced at sea? But what's the biggest challenge you've faced in your career? And I think, what's the biggest surprise as well?
Oh, that is a very, very good question. I think the biggest challenge, I'm going to be honest, has come down to people. Not necessarily other people. I'd probably say also myself in that, in some respects. I did start when I was 16. Probably some of the ways I responded to certain situations in the early years of my cadetship, in fact, the early years of my career, probably even as a senior officer, I'd even say, in my late 20s, were probably not how I would respond now. And I think that's human nature. I think we can all look back at our careers, regardless of what sector we're in, and think, yes, we do evolve and mature and get life experience. But certainly the biggest challenges and the biggest impact has been from the actions of other people. And there has been a lot of going against the status quo. And with that comes some challenging behaviour from some people and some, to be honest, quite unacceptable behaviour from some people. And I still look back and I'm amazed how I stuck it out and through some of the early years, because there were some pretty unpleasant times. All the way through, there were some quite unpleasant times, but especially the early years, I wonder, you know, how did I stick it out? And it was that passion for, I wanted to be a seafarer, this was my chosen career, that I put that down to a saving grace so that definitely was the biggest challenge.
The word passion has come up a couple of times in this recording so far, and bit of a sort of look behind the curtain, but you know, Anne and I have worked together on a couple of things previously, and that was one of the reasons I really wanted to get you on here, because your passion for the industry, I'd say, comes across immediately to anyone who meets you, and it's engaging, and it's, I always enjoy talking to you.
Yes, I think passion helps. I think we all perform well when we're passionate about something, but equally, one of my biggest pieces of advice to people is always be curious, and if you have that spark of curiosity, it's like a spark of passion, and I think the two can align quite well, and you can find yourself in places you never thought you'd find yourself, like Mauritius. Yeah. If you'd have ever asked me if I'd be working in a shore job in Mauritius, I'd have thought you were daft, and I had 2 years working as DPA Mauritius, so that is purely on curiosity more than anything else.
I'd like to say that as well. I put it down to some bravery as well. From an outside perspective, you know, it's all well and good being curious and passionate, but you know, some of these moves that you've made, you know, from an outsider's perspective, just seem brave. And I think that anyone making this move ashore, or making any move in industry, is so easy, regardless of where you work or what industry you work in. Making a career change is difficult, and you do need that bravery. You can see the amount that you've put into it, but I'd say that anyone who's looking to move ashore, looking to move within the industry, you know, that's a big thing. You've got to be brave. If you're not happy in what you're doing, you've got to be brave about it.
I've always struggled with self-confidence. I always will. And I will always see a job advert and think, 10 people are going to get that job before me. I don't meet the requirements. There's no point applying. All these things go through my head pretty much on a weekly basis. Even now, I have this thing called LinkedIn-itis, my husband calls it, where I look at LinkedIn and I see the jobs that everybody else has and thinks they're all far better than me. And that could have limited my career massively. And I'm amazed it hasn't, to be fair. But I don't know where from. Maybe it's because I've had to be brave my whole career at sea when things have gone really horribly wrong sometimes, and I've been stuck on the ship when horrible things have been happening, and you have to dig deep into some pot of bravery somewhere. But yeah, maybe it's just too easy to click easy apply sometimes on jobs. I don't know. But there has to be, whatever works for you, there has to be something that drives, if that is also you, if you're listening to this podcast and you think, that is me, I look at a job description or a job advert and I think, I'm just not up to the grade, what's the harm in applying? They can only say no. And we all know people that are in jobs that haven't met every requirement of the job description, but the people interviewing them have seen that passion, that spark, that curiosity, that potential. So I would always say, yeah, don't rule yourself out of any sector, any branch of a career change, and just go for it.
Really good advice. During that advice, you were talking about digging deep and, you know, seeing and learning sort of that bravery within yourself and going for it. Is that the most important skill you'd say you learn at sea, or would you say what would you say you learned from being at sea?
I think it is probably one of the strongest things that I've learned at sea. I would like to say that there are skills like flexibility. Seafarers have this innate ability, and it's certainly developed in us throughout our careers at sea, where you have to face different situations. You're a firefighter, you're a paramedic, you're a DIY handyman, you know, you're all these things and more on top of being a deck officer, an engineer officer, whatever role you have at sea. You can have four or five other roles, even as an ordinary seaman or as a catering rating, you will have muster list duties. So we're very used to being flexible and adaptable, and I think that to me is one of the real assets. If you're a shore manager listening to this, maybe even another sector, thinking, why should I hire a seafarer? You will struggle to find many people more flexible and adaptable than seafarers, because these are people that have been in a steel can floating around having to fix and solve any problem that comes their way. And there aren't very many people in the world that do jobs like that anymore. So to me, it's the flexibility, but it's also that digging deep and facing difficult situations. Again, because I was on a steel can in the middle of the water, and I had to. There was certainly a lot of times when I was a cadet and a junior officer, there were no seafarer helplines like thankfully we have now, and there was no internet on board. There was no way to call for help. So it's that digging deep that... sure, I still have challenging situations now and think I don't dig deep enough, but it's that digging deep that I had to do then that I think has followed me through my career ashore, that has given me, I don't normally like the term resilience, but I'm actually going to say a little bit of resilience sometimes in the tough situations, but also some of the wisdom sometimes to think, this doesn't feel right, this doesn't feel safe, this doesn't feel like the right career path anymore. I was in a very successful job during COVID, senior management, and I felt like there was a new challenge.
Yeah.
And it's that, again, that openness to say, right, I'm going to be brave. I'm going to see what else is out there. A few of my friends know that I'm quite bonkers in the fact that I will leave a job before I found a new job sometimes, just because otherwise we get stuck in this trap of we're comfortable where we are. So yeah, it's that bravery to say, I'm going to leave this ship, whether this ship is an actual ship or whether it's a shore job, and try something else, being curious.
100%. I did a very similar thing, actually. When I left sea, I gave my notice to finish with my contract, because otherwise I thought, you know, you do your 3 months and then you have your 3 months off and you end up never leaving, and you get those handcuffs, and I knew it wasn't right for me. What I would say is, for me, I'd be interested in your perspective. For me, I had done some calculations to work out that I would be okay. So don't just do it. But you know, as long as you can work out that it'll work out for yourself, you know, taking that plunge. I've rarely found people who have been in that situation where they want to leave so much that they're willing to do that, that when they've come out the other side, they're less happy for doing it.
I think as a seafarer, you have a few advantages in this situation over maybe people that want to leave a job and do a new job or a new sector ashore, in that when you're on board, you're typically spending less. Even if you've got bills at home, you're spending less. So you can save up a little bit of a nest egg, so you can plan a little bit for the move. I also find that, yeah, some seafarers get tax back, for example. Yeah. So you can say, right, next year's tax is going to be my slush funds to try and find a new job or to upskill. We have seafarers, we have a lot of time if we're on rotation, or we can study on board, and there's opportunities there to say, right, I'm going to devote a little bit of money here to my career path, which is maybe a little bit difficult when you're ashore. So I think that helps in taking that plunge. There are certainly, each decision was pretty much calculated. I knew I could do it, but at the same time, it's that investing in what could come next.
And that leads us on perfectly. You've said, it's like you've read the script there, Anne. Not that there is a script. But I was going to ask you about, where do you see your seafaring career take? Well, not necessarily your seafaring career. You're split between shore and sea at the moment. Where do you see yourself going next?
I think one thing that I've realised in the last 20 years is that, or 24 years, I think now, I started in 2000, so yeah, 24 years this year, is that wherever I think I'm going to end up next, I will not end up next. I think when I was at sea, I think as a cadet, I said, oh yeah, I'll be at sea and then one day I'll be a pilot. And now I know I have no real desire to be a pilot. I don't quite know where that came from. I think it was this sort of societal idea that you'll be a successful seafarer and then the only sort of crown on top will be a pilot or something. Somebody put this idea into my head and, oh, I needed to be a pilot. But I know that's not where I want to go. So now having said that on a podcast, you'll probably find I end up as a pilot next year. Because wherever I think I'm not going to end up, I tend to end up. I did a few trips last year as skipper and master on some really varied vessels, actually. I'd had a long period ashore and I thought, right, I want to see if I can still do the job and have I got my sea legs. And really important point here for seafarers that are thinking of coming ashore and a little bit nervous about doing so, you can always go back to sea. One thing I always kept up was my ticket, and to me it was that insurance policy that I can always go back to sea. I did 10 years ashore and look at me, last year I went back to sea because I could.
Absolutely, and just to jump in here, we may have said it on a previous podcast even, but you know, it's while we are the Coming Ashore podcast, I've spoken about this with other mentors, with people at the Marine Society who run it, and you know, it's not that coming ashore is the end goal. Okay, right. The end goal is that you got to be happy within whatever you're doing, and you know, if you come ashore for a bit and then you decide to go back, that's fine. But the main thing, and the quite amazing thing there is, you know, you've got that flexibility to within this industry to actually, you can come ashore for a bit, you can go back. The main thing is that you do what's right for you.
Yeah, and certainly, you know, I'd had 10 years in mainly office jobs apart from this offshore superintendency for 2 years, and I was nervous. Could I still be at sea? Did I still know the coal regs? And actually, I've been doing some tutoring lately as well to try and make sure that I do still know what I used to know, because I hate the idea of skills fade. So, and I just thought, I'm worried. Am I no longer a seafarer? And being a seafarer is so much part of my identity. I'd started to get this complex that maybe I wasn't. And I went back on. So the first ship I went on was SDPO last summer, and yeah, first watch, it was like I'd never been away for 10 or 11 years. Fit right back in. And I took the vessel alongside in Germany, or I took her off the berth, one of the two, and I was really nervous. It was the first ship handling I'd done in a long, long time. And yeah, it was like I'd never been away. And then after that, I ended up as skipper of a 7-meter boat in Germany. They needed Master Unlimited for a 7-meter boat. And for 6 weeks. And it was one of the most fun jobs I've ever had in the industry. So never rule yourself out. You come ashore, but the skills you get ashore, just like the skills you develop at sea are useful for a shore job, it works both ways. And this is the one thing I have really learned only in the last few years, is that now I see the skills that I've developed ashore are so useful for vessel management afloat. Another piece of advice that I always hold quite close is that if you are a seafarer and you've come ashore, don't lose that seafarer mentality. There's a lot of mariners that I know that have come ashore that then I wonder, have they ever been to sea, because they seem to change. And I just think that it's really important that we all understand each other. We've all been through similar training, similar experiences, but some of the skills that I developed ashore, I've found in the last sort of 6 months or a year, have really helped me afloat, and the sort of leadership and management, but also the change of perspective to understand the stresses ashore, how certain decisions are made, where sometimes on the ship you can be quite blinkered or you don't see the full picture. And it gave me a much greater understanding, where before I would be swearing and shouting at decisions made by the office and not understanding them and writing very snotty emails sometimes. Whereas now, I may still write some snotty emails, but I do have a little bit of a better understanding as to the background behind why some of those decisions were made.
Hmm. And I guess that comes down to the understanding between both ship and shore, and, you know, vice versa. You know, you need to, it's good that you've got an understanding of what it's like shoreside, but I think it's really important that people who have never worked at sea as well try to understand what it's like to work at sea, which is one of the reasons we're doing this podcast. Yeah. So if you could have one thing that you wanted the wider industry to know about seafarers, what would that be?
It's going to sound corny and cliched, but I think it's that seafarers really matter. We see, when we fly out on holiday, we see pilots and airport terminals, and we see a lot of the land-based supply chain every day. We see the delivery truck coming to the supermarket and we think, oh yeah, that delivery truck has brought the bananas to the supermarket. Whereas no, it was that ship that I was on at 16 that delivered the bananas from the origin country that then enabled the truck to take it to the supermarket.
Mm.
And that was by seafarers. So I think the fact that seafarers matter, and the fact that seafarers are ordinary folk who choose to do what is quite an extraordinary career. And I think, again, this is what hiring managers in maybe some other sectors might not appreciate. There is this sort of sea blindness out there, and nobody has, you know, there are a lot of people that don't necessarily have this understanding of quite what an extraordinary career seafaring is. The fact that it's a profession that has existed for millennia, and we have men and women, we have youngsters, we have people in their 60s and 70s still actively seafaring, and this is what makes the world go round. And we're seeing it at the moment with geopolitical situation. We've seen it with the Suez Canal a few years ago. But then it seems to drop off. So I think the one thing that I really would want the wider industry, and certainly the general public, to know is that curiosity that I was saying that seafarers should have if they're thinking about coming ashore is the same curiosity that the wider public I'd like to have of, oh, what is it the seafarers do apart from drive the ship? You know, the fact that there's this huge medical chest on board that somebody's responsible for, that you can be giving IV to a person with, you know, you have to put out fires with real firefighting equipment, whatever it may be, understanding the sheer breadth of experiences that seafarers have.
I think that's a really nice note to leave it on, so thank you, Anne. And unfortunately, that is all the time we have today. So I'd just like to say thank you for joining us, Anne. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you.
Thanks very much for having me. It's been a fun podcast. I've enjoyed this one.
Good. I'm glad. And thank you to everyone who is listening today from all of us at the Coming Ashore podcast. We hope you've enjoyed this episode as much as we've enjoyed recording it. And we hope that you will join us for the next one.
Thank you for listening. Please don't forget to subscribe or follow us on YouTube and Spotify to get notified on all things related to the podcast. For more information, email comingashore@ms-sc.org or visit marine-society.org/coming-ashore.